Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Football is many things. Unpredictable, exciting, colourful, passionate, absorbing, expensive.
Venal, infuriating, exasperating, time-consuming, depressing. But one thing it most certainly is not, is a level playing field.
Welcome to the famous sloping pitch.
Calmer week for Angus Kinnear, Leeds history-loving managing director, who compared proposed changes in football finance to Maoism in the club programme. He stopped short of apologising, but his programme notes for Saturday's game against Arsenal mercifully steer clear of Mao and the death of millions during the Great Leap Forward. Instead, reports have said that he will describe Leeds' injury troubles as the modern-day Black Death and the full-time players' scuffle at Chelsea as worse than the Battle of Stalingrad.
Yes.
Leaving him nowhere to go with the 7-0 defeat at Man City, which he says was disappointing.
Which in itself is disappointing, but still. Yeah. A week in which also Tyson Fury threatened to sue the Sports Personality of the Year if they put him on the shortlist. Sports Personality of the Year put him on the shortlist, a spokesman saying, by threatening to sue us, Tyson demonstrated more personality than the other contenders put together, so our hands were tied. I mean, look at them. And they didn't put Lewis Hamilton on the shortlist, did they? Almost as if they knew Formula One would find a way of fucking it up, so Max Verstappen would win it. I know you don't really follow it at all, but they managed to change the rules of the whole bloody sport with a lap and a half to go before the end of the season. It was absolutely extraordinary. It was like deciding halfway through a penalty shootout that one team has to take all their kicks left-footed.
Yeah, I quite liked it. Do you know, I did see some of it because it was on Channel 4. And I would normally, as you well know, Chris, go nowhere near it. If I want to see...
Was Aussie Gold Hunters not on?
It wasn't on. If I want to see... It's the series is finished, actually.
Has it?
If I want to see reckless driving, suicidal overtaking and the occasional crash, I live next to a motorway bridge here. I can just stand on that and see all of that stuff,
so
no problem at all. Anyway, just to say, of course, that Lewis Hamilton was knighted by Prince Charles only yesterday. And the Honours Committee citation said that the knighthood was in part for Hamilton's contributions in sport and equality. Mainly, however, the Queen had approved it because she thought, and I quote, it would really piss off David Beckham.
It was.
I like that safety car thing that they do.
Do you?
Yeah. Don't you think? I don't know. I don't know who the goodies and baddies are. But
yeah, the safety car is the baddie, yeah.
Oh, the baddie. Okay, but don't you think they could do it in football if somebody's injured?
Yeah, right, they have a thing in the Formula One called the virtual safety car where everything has to reduce to 40% of the pace.
Well, that's what
so
I'm saying.
They could just reduce to 40% of the pace.
Well, yeah, they play
then
walking
I could
football.
Play.
They play walking football until,
until the
players
the
be dealt with and then carry on again. Because it'd be great, they'd have a klaxon and they'd all start running like... I'm going to say Billy-O, although I know that makes me sound incredibly old.
It's like
but
bunter.
It was the word that came.
You were expecting a postal order.
Yes, I was.
So, yeah, as you say, Sir Lewis Hamilton got formally knighted by Prince Charles in a slightly fancier ceremony than you can expect at the Sports Personality of the Year, I think. Although Prince Charles was up for tarting it up a bit by drinking champagne out of a boot while playing March of the Toreadors. Had to be talked out of it, apparently, by an equerry. Emma Raducanu is obviously going to win Sports Personality of the Year, but she's currently isolating with COVID, so likely to have to receive the trophy in an Abu Dhabi hotel room from Virginia Wade in a hazmat suit. It's going to take the edge off that live show, isn't it?
Well, it's great because she won't know it's Virginia Wade, will she?
And maybe it won't have to be.
It could be anybody.
It could be anyone with a picture of Virginia Wade on the helmet.
Yeah, they could do all of the awards like that. Hazmat suit on and just claim it's Pelé. That is, there's Pelé over there. Yeah. Here's Edward the Confessor.
It was also, of course, a week, this won't have passed you by, in which Sergio Aguero announced his retirement after only five games for Barcelona because of health problems, poor chap. A fine player, no doubt about it, in his time. There was a stat in the paper that Aguero could, in fact, play 28 more Premier League games without scoring and still have the best minutes per goal ratio of any Premier League player. But still, not as good as Jimmy Greaves, just saying. Yeah. Nearly twice as many goals in nearly twice as many games. Never gets mentioned. Still, it's always gratifying, when there's a Premier League goal stat that Alan Shearer isn't top of. He shouldn't have it all his own way, should he?
Yeah, but he is. If you're having a quiz, like, for instance, they had in Downing Street, you know, Alan Shearer and Les Ferdinand are your go-to answers.
Your go-to answers there.
Or Nicholas Anelka, if it's a player from outside the British Isles.
Well, of course. Yeah. Anyway, before we unwrap the biggest present under the tree, the one shaped like a bike that metaphorically represents the sheer festive magic of the Premier League, let us first root around in the bottom of our Christmas stockings for the inexplicable walnut left over from last year that is the very bottom of the EFL, where Oldham Athletic, my team, are still in the bottom two, despite an astonishing 10-goal thriller against league leaders Forest Green Rovers last Saturday.
So excited. I was excited. Yeah, never mind you.
I think a lot of people just watching it on the Vidi printer were excited, I think.
Although, I tell you what, I was listening to Sports Report, and they said, and the most incredible result is at Boundary Park. And then when they said it was a draw, I was a little bit disappointed for you.
Yeah, I mean.
I know 5-5 is great for everyone else.
No, it is great.
For you, you'd have liked 5-4, wouldn't you?
Yeah, or 6-5, yeah. There's 12
minutes.
Yeah.
You're not greedy.
No, not at all. And Forest Green, of course, indisputably the most eco-friendly club in the league. They play in green. They have green in their name. Their ground is called the New Lawn. How green is that? And they've been given the go-ahead to build a new ground. Did you know this? Entirely out of timber. Apparently.
Really?
And they only serve vegan food, and their playing staff have to commit to the vegan lifestyle when they join. According to 442 magazine, at their recent game against Walsall, a Rovers player went down injured, and the Saddlers fans started singing, "He's eating our grass, he's eating our grass, the vegan bastard, he's eating our grass."
That's very, very
which I like.
Good.
Yeah, it was an astonishing game on Saturday. I mean, Oldham took the lead with a worldie from Davis Keeler-Dunn after 10 minutes, picked up the ball
Davis
in the centre circle.
Davis Keeler-Dunn, legs burnished it, yeah.
Yes, as you say. He picked up the ball in the centre circle, knocked it a few yards forward, and then just smacked it. And people in the crowd were going, "Shoot!" as a joke, because he was so far out. And you know how often a goal is described in a match report as, oh, he hit it from 30 yards out, and then you see it, and you can see from the pattern of how the grass is mown that it can't be that far.
Yeah, well, sometimes it's in the area when they say that.
This was that far. This was just beyond the centre circle. Amazing goal. But anyway, the vegans equalised a couple of minutes later, and just after half-time, they were leading 4-1, and we were bottom of the league. And I was feeling like I'd done it to myself as well. Do you remember last week, I declined to describe our ground as Fortress Boundary Park and suggested, "Welcome, Matt, Boundary Park." Remember that?
Yeah.
Well, Jamil Matt scored 2, and so did Matt Stevens. So welcome all Matts. I did it to myself. And that's what happened if you jab the gods of football with a pointy stick.
Can I just ask you, when you say the vegans, is that actually their nickname?
It might as well be.
Okay, because they sound a little bit like Star Trek baddies.
Or out of Hitchhikers, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, when it was 4-1, it looked like it was going to be a question of how many. You know, the sort of game you only keep watching in case it's going to turn into a historic catastrophe. You know, but then Oldham got back to 2-4, then 3-4. Forest Green made it 5-3, and we thought, you know, so much for that comeback. But then it's 4-5, and finally 5-5, and the fifth goal was an own goal, which is even better. And, you know, 12 minutes for one team or the other to make it 6-5, but that didn't happen. Apparently, we've never had a 5-5 before. Apparently, in the club's history, no. We had a 5-4 win a few years back against Peterborough when we were 3-0 down at half time, and half the crowd left. And just didn't see this amazing comeback. But it was a shame there weren't more people to see and get enthused, you know, by Saturday's game, because there was a stay-away protest happening called Empty the Park. And a couple of weeks ago, there was a Pack the Park initiative. You remember when we played Port Vale and we had an
exciting win?
Pack the Park to show the owners what might be possible if they only get their act together, you know. And this was part two, to show them just how dire things could get if they carry on the way they're going. And there'll have been so many people cursing the protest organisers when they heard the results.
So you've got two major protests and you've got 4 points out of them.
Yes. Yes. But the empty the park thing is of dubious value anyway, because the owners, you know, they declared a crowd of 3,600, even though there was clearly only just over 1,000 there, according to estimates and, you know, various headcounts that people did. But the club counted all the season ticket stayaways as tickets sold. So, you know, as a protest, it could have worked out better, I think.
Well, I think they do that everywhere, don't they?
There was the game that was on last night had a much larger crowd than appeared to be. Was it?
Yes.
I forget which game that was now. But anyway, there's no getting away from the fact that the COVID is the big story this week, isn't it? I mean, a record.
Yeah, not least amongst us.
Not least, exactly, yeah. Because we're doing this remotely for the first time rather than going into the studio, and our producers, Mark and Dave, are currently suffering from it and producing it from their bed. Now, they're two separate beds in two separate parts of London. They do, but I don't think they're in it. Anyway, there was an oddly paradoxical day in Parliament earlier in the week, wasn't there, COVID-related, as 99 Tory MPs demonstrated that they're out of step with public opinion by voting against the introduction of a COVID vaccine pass, but that they're very much in step with current public thinking by voting against Boris Johnson. And COVID passes, this is the line we've reached now, COVID passes will be required for football from this weekend, in the bigger games at least. It makes me wonder, because it's crowds of over 10,000, it makes me wonder what the situation is for games that might get a crowd of 10,000. You know, or it might only be 8 because of Christmas shopping.
Yeah.
Or people staying away because of the COVID thing.
Yeah. Well, say the 10,000 and first person goes into the ground. Everyone else has got to come out.
Everyone's got to come out again.
For their things. Absolutely.
Queue up.
I quite like the idea that at some stage a COVID pass is going to become a thing in football.
Yeah.
You know, as in a very unsuccessful thing. Oh, it's a COVID pass.
He was clean through and he completely COVIDed it.
Absolutely.
Apparently, Carlisle and Lincoln have capped their ground capacity at 9,999 to avoid requiring COVID passports, which sounds pretty bloody optimistic for me. Especially Carlisle, who are doing almost as badly as we are. Although they've been pulling gently away thanks to their new Keith bounce. But I think Tranmere also have said they won't allow in more than 10,000 people.
And either of them sponsored by the 99p shop. Because
where everything now costs £1.15 because of inflation. Yeah. Anyway, so as the week has gone on, you know, the story has become less about crowds and the advisability of attending games and more about the games themselves being off altogether. Mm. You know, and Spurs were first, weren't they? Something that hasn't been said since the first three games of Nuno's reign. When they called off their European game with Rennes and then the Premier League game with Brighton. Sheffield United QPR was off on Monday. Brentford Man United on Tuesday. Burnley Watford was called off about 5 o'clock yesterday. Plenty of Watford fans taking the day off work were already in Burnley.
Yes.
And Brendan Rodgers has finally managed, I think, to get Leicester's game with Spurs postponed. He's been trying unsuccessfully for several days now, but he foolishly made the mistake of declaring that the players missing were a mixture of COVID cases and injuries. So it's not the same. And anyway, I think there was a feeling that Spurs were already pushing their luck.
Obviously the pools companies who've been very badly hit by sort of in-play betting and the lottery and things like that, but they do endure. You still have it. And obviously they have a pools panel, and they've decided if something goes really badly wrong, they're going to do it on number of COVID cases. So you get Tottenham Hotspur 13, Norwich City 4, Leicester City 6, Manchester United 19. That'd be rather good fun.
I think that'd be good, and I'm hoping that the pools panel would have at least the modern equivalent of Derek Dugan on it. He was always on the pools panel, wasn't he?
Well, it used to be Roger Hunt and Gordon Banks, but sadly both have departed in recent years.
Anyway,
I'm not hoping there is. Can I just say I'm hoping, and I know this will go down badly, but I'm hoping that's what I go for all the time. I'm hoping there will be another lockdown, because I got quite close to a record during the last one. Really decided to work hard at it. And you know those pedometer things, you know, that tell you how many steps you do in a day?
Yeah.
I was trying to do the fewest steps possible for a healthy person to do. And I got down to, my record was 7.
Yeah.
But it did involve pissing in a drawer. But I think I can improve on it. I really do. And that's what I'm going for. So, you know, it's an ill wind, isn't it?
Oh, Christ, the pedometer.
Yeah, yeah, let's not go there. Yeah, yeah.
So another draw. Anyway, as with any new set of circumstances, there's a suspicion that clubs are trying to manipulate things for their own benefit. I mean, it's the nature of the beast, isn't it? You know, Rodgers claiming that Leicester are being discriminated against, Norwich claimed the Premier League wouldn't take their calls about calling off the Villa game. Big Q's
wouldn't take their calls.
Wouldn't take their calls. That's what Norwich is claiming. Yeah, that the Premier League.
Fantastic, is it? Sorry, he's just popped out for his lunch.
Yeah,
he's just getting a sandwich.
Apparently, the Premier League are supposed to be considering each thing on a case by case basis. Teams are supposed to have 14 players available, but some of the cases they're obviously just not interested in hearing at all. I mean, there've been systems in place since the start of the season in France, apparently, to scan COVID passes. At the same time as you scan tickets, you know, so you've got a barcode on the ticket. Yeah. And so it's scan, and in you go kind of thing. But not here. We haven't got that here. We haven't got anything like that.
Just
see the
huge,
huge queues to get checked into on the way into the Amex in Brighton yesterday and at the Emirates. You know, we haven't got anywhere. We just don't have any admin skills to pull off anything like this.
Well, and also, I really suspect that the clubs don't really know what it is they're meant to do. It's like you remember for a time they used to have the terrorist things where everybody got searched before going into a ground.
Yeah,
and then they gave it up after like 2 weeks, as if you know the ideology had disappeared from the world. That there wasn't nobody was interested in terrorism anymore. But it's just.
But you still have to take your laces out of your shoes when you get on a plane. But still,
yes. But they just don't have the flexibility. I think that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
As organisations.
Well, it's difficult to know what the best thing to do is, isn't it? I mean, Thomas Frank, the Brentford manager, is calling for all this weekend's games to be called off.
Yes.
To make a sort of fire break. So that everyone can, I think it's pie in the sky myself, but he could, so that everyone could get better and then we'll all be ready for Boxing Day.
Yes.
You know, it's.
But I imagine that my dear friend Angus Kinnear will be wanting the season written off in the same way that he was furious when it was threatened to be written off when Leeds looked like they were coming up. So I think he'd like to sort of impose let's go to his world, an interdict, which was when the churches were all shut in 2008, I believe.
Yes.
Anyway, Angus will know.
He'll know, and it'll be in the programme next week.
Yeah. Of course.
Anyway, now, last weekend, you'll have been paying attention. There were an extraordinary rash of match-deciding penalties, and by no means all of them were the sort you expect to see given in the era of VAR. I mean, it started on Friday night when Brentford were given a 96-minute penalty to win their game against Watford, which was fine, but and you know, it enlivened the picnic-ruining, stinging insects derby, you know, the bees against the hornets. Did you see when the TV put their badges up next to each other? Like, it's Brentford against Watford. Brentford have a bee because they're the bees, and Watford are the hornets, and they've got like a moose. What's that? They've put a moose on their badge. What's that about? But anyway, and then on Saturday, City beat Wolves with a penalty, Liverpool beat Villa with a penalty, Chelsea beat
Leeds, didn't they?
Two penalties, so it beat Leeds 3-2. Manchester United won thanks to a penalty given when Ronaldo was wrestled to the ground by his freakish neck, which ought really to count as justifiable homicide, I think. But it's clearly a dive, as if any normal human being could get their hands around that neck. But anyway, I think you had to feel a bit sorry for Norwich, although seeing the photographs of all the Norwich fans with their phones out taking pictures of Ronaldo's goal celebration took the edge off that. So I think they deserve to go down just for that.
Yeah, God, that's terrible. That's awful.
And there was even a penalty that kicked off the scoring in Leicester's thrashing of Newcastle, wasn't there?
Yeah.
And,
Well, the whole Newcastle thing is, and you know, I'm sure lots of people said it, but we said when Mohamed bin Salman took over, we said, yeah, but he can't buy any players till January, and you can't see this team getting much, much better. And if they're into real, real, real shit, you know, come the end of the Christmas period, you know, that's it. So I've been looking into, I mean, you probably know I'm not the most technically gifted person. Well, I'm not gifted in any way, to tell you honestly. But
I was wondering what technically was doing in there.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not a gifted person. but I've started ordering things on Amazon, as I think I've told you. Now, they have a thing where you can send things back. And I'm wondering if there is some sort of cooling off period for buying a football club. You know, and if being he'd be able to say, you know, oh, it wasn't what I was expecting,
yeah.
or it doesn't fit, or it was broken when it got here. I think that would be
bigger,
a really,
bigger
really
boys
good
broke it. Yeah,
yeah. But you wonder, you wonder if he even knows that relegation exists.
Well, they're going to struggle. They're in the paper. They're cheerfully being linked with Kieran Trippier, for instance,
yes.
and Dele Alli. And Jesse Lingard. And the thing that these guys have in common is they all will have an eye on being at the World Cup in less than a year now. And they're going to find themselves in the Championship if they go to Newcastle. You know, it's a risk that you wouldn't take, I think.
But what they will be is safe from COVID, because Newcastle do an awful lot of social distancing, especially at corners, I've noticed, and indeed any moments when they have to mark. Can I do you the list? I'll do this as quickly as I can. Right. Here are my Newcastle rumours. This is only from the last 3 weeks. Tyrese Campbell, Icardi, Fofana, Van der Beek, Lingard, Martial, Bailey, Ramsey, Elneny, Dembele, Favre, Insigne, Modric, Glitch, Nunes, Witzel, Zinchenko, Kamara, Trippier, Sadiq, Origi, Barkley, Vlahovic, Coutinho, Tarkovsky, Rabiot, Henderson, Lacazette, Guendouzi, Testegen, Adeyemi, Dele Alli, Saar, Eden Hazard, Connor Cody, Calvert-Lewin, Declan Rice, Jude Bellingham, Clement Lenglen, and Kylian Mbappe. And just to top it all, Denver Barr has offered to come out of retirement.
Faustino Asprilla is coming out of retirement. Yeah.
I mean, that's the most ridiculous
list. They have a budget of 50 million, aren't they, to spend on players? And they're going to get 1.5 of those guys at the very most, aren't they?
Oh, God, yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Tarkovsky on his own is worth 50 million, you know, I think. Yeah. But anyway. It's been quite enjoyable over the last few days as a neutral looking forward to the World Cup next November. How many up-and-coming England prospects have been playing out of their skin lately, not trying to get a move to Newcastle, obviously. Do you see Conor Gallagher had a terrific game for Palace?
He's a really good player.
Really good player.
I saw him play for Charlton against us a couple of years ago, and he looked really good.
Fantastic.
There.
And then the Arsenal game, Saka and Smith-Rowe playing out of their skins. They were great. Mm. And did you see that Ward-Prowse free kick last night? They're saying he's the best, dead ball kicker since Letizia, which is quite a high bar, isn't it?
Yeah, but they've been saying that for a long time, haven't they?
Yeah, well, he's just now, he's been doing great free kicks, and now just his stats are catching up with how good he is.
Oh, I see what you mean, yeah.
I mean, Southgate showed himself, didn't he, in the summer, ready to bring on subs to take penalties. Maybe Ward-Prowse is worth his place in the squad, just in case we get a dangerous free kick with a few minutes to go. You know, he can come on and rescue a game. I mean, I like him. He's a useful player, but his free kicks.
But
are just...
I think I was thinking about your brum brum thing that you enjoy with the cars and stuff. I was thinking that Southgate, in some ways, is the safety car, isn't he?
Yes.
He just hold on. Just keep it nice and calm.
Yeah, yeah. Did you see the very enjoyable cock up of the knockout round draw for the European tournaments on Friday? In
priceless. It's so pleasing.
And then was it Friday or was it Monday? I can't remember. Anyway, embarrassing for UEFA. They had to do them again 3 hours later, owing to some balls up. Presumably they didn't put some of the little plastic balls in the fridge for long enough and they warmed up to room temperature.
They didn't know which ones to pick to cheat.
Yeah, I mean, they did all look a bit like kids not doing something right the first time and going, practice go, doesn't count.
Yeah.
Poor Andre Arshavin, who's the designated ball fondler, you know, having to go through it all again. He looked miserable as sin the first time.
I also thought it was so pathetic that they didn't just say sorry. They had to say it was an outside server, nothing to do with us. It was a computer from another company. And you just think, oh, for goodness, you may as well say, I'm sorry.
One bloke who was supposed to put a ball in a bowl and he didn't bloody do it.
That's the equivalent of saying, I'm sorry, but Andre Arshavin was on antibiotics. So his behaviour couldn't really be.
And then he'd had a half a shandy. So, you know you're not supposed to. Yeah. And the first round, the draw threw up, which was what was described as a mouth-watering tie. You see that between Paris Saint-Germain and Man United. So, you know, Messi against Ronaldo, as though there were no other players involved in the tournament at all. Yeah. Yeah, it's mouth-watering in the sense that, well, you know how sometimes you get a bit of mouth-watering just before you're violently sick?
Yeah.
That sort of mouth-watering.
Or when you're at the dentist.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get it then too. They did keep using those phrases. They said, that was the tie everybody wanted. And you think, really?
I thought it was very suspicious, to be honest. I mean, they said that the draw had to be redone because it should have been possible for Manchester United to draw Atletico Madrid. Then they did it again and Manchester United drew Atletico Madrid. Yeah. I mean, how are these people not in jail?
See, that was fair.
Yeah, exactly. And it's mystifying to me that, given that United barely squeaked past Norwich at the weekend, that they're immediately pronounced favourites to beat Atletico Madrid because Liverpool did, you know. And Liverpool thrashed United. I'm looking forward to watching Diego Simeone refusing to shake hands with Ralph Rangnick and Suarez trying to bite Ronaldo's neck and just bouncing off holding his poor teeth. That's what I'm looking forward to seeing.
Well, these are the joys, you see, of European
Did you
football.
See that the person who writes jokes for Bruno Fernandes' social media accounts posted, "What time is the third round of the draw?" Tears of laughter emoji, which makes it not a joke anymore.
I tell you what, those boys must have a laugh, mustn't they? In the dressing room. I bet they're pissing themselves all the time with stuff like that. Right, we're going to take a break, and in a moment we'll have our guest. Now, we've been very fortunate to have so many different types of guests. Footballers with their insights, comics with their opinions, and occasionally insiders with their unique perspectives. Our guest today has been at the very heart of professional sport for three decades at least, running the Professional Cricketers Association and latterly the League Managers Association. He's represented, consulted with, and listened to football managers across the divisions, and with that, obtained a unique insight into the beautiful and not so beautiful game. Welcome to Richard Bevan. You're very welcome, Richard.
Thanks, guys.
Now, just so people are familiar with exactly what the LMA is, probably not as well known as the PFA, although the PFA are trying very hard, as far as I can tell, to disappear completely and are fantastically silent. But would you mind, just for the sake of the uninitiated, letting us know what the LMA are kind of about?
Sure. So I joined the organisation 13, 14 years ago, and we started looking into the history of the LMA, actually, because we went back as far as 1919, and we dug up the minutes, which has got some amazing stories in it. And the guys met after the First World War and formed the association, which was called the Secretaries and Coaches Association. And it's got its history all through the First World War, the Second World War, and other big issues in different decades, which has actually taught us quite a few lessons about COVID as well. And then in 1992, the likes of Sir Alex Ferguson, Harold Wilkinson, Laurie McMenemy, Graham Taylor, and a number of other great managers of that time defined the managers separate to the coaches. So it became the League Managers Association. And we're a team of 20 people with about 80 consultants, which are made up of lawyers, doctors, accountants, professionals. And a simple way of looking at what we do is that we're facilitators. So if you're a member of the LMA and you have a contractual problem, a health problem, a technical problem, a family problem, whatever it might be, then we find the very best people to look after you and pay the bills. But it's an association with eight pillars of business. And if you were to look, as we are at the moment, about where we would be in, say, 5 years' time, yes, we got great lawyers, great healthcare, but actually what we're developing is the LMA Institute, which is the business school for coaches and managers. We currently have about 900 going through the various programs, and we hopefully will become the best coaches business school in the world in that time frame. And that's our goal, and that's where we're traveling.
Right. Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that in 1992 that distinction was made between coaches and managers, and strange enough, that distinction is becoming very much more blurred these days, isn't it? If you look at the Watford model, for instance, you get a lot of people coming as head coach. The job of the manager has certainly changed a great deal. I mean, if you're going to speak to, Howard Wilkinson or Ron Atkinson, they will have gone through a massive change from the influence a manager had over not just the team, but the club to, you know, just being responsible for the current players.
Yes, it's a good point. But equally, our legal team have got the contracts of all the managers. So whether you're a manager or head coach, pretty much the job remit and the details of the contract are very similar. Going back to the history of the LMA, we found in 1922, I think it was a Herbert Chapman, the famous Arsenal manager.
And Huddersfield too.
Yes, absolutely. I think it was at Leeds as well. He actually chaired a meeting when the owners of clubs sat around a table and said, "We're beginning to pay players more money and we need to understand their values." So perhaps we can meet with senior coaches and talk about values. And they called the group managers. And we were talking the other week. I wonder if that's where it's come from. If you look at the,
right.
If you look at the Premier League, a lot of our owners are overseas and they don't use the word football managers. Maybe Italy does, but in the main, they're head coaches. So I think it's more about what owners tend to call their senior managers, as opposed to trying to define out the role of a manager or a head coach.
Yeah, but even so, the phrase football manager has from like the 70s, from when Nick and I was first watching football, the managers were these great sort of charismatic Shankleys and Matt Busbys and Bob Paisley, and they were people who had. It made you feel like they had control of everything, had control of every aspect of the club.
Yeah.
And it seems now that even though there's a great thing where football clubs matches seem to be portrayed as one iconic figurehead manager against another, nonetheless they seem to have less responsibility than they once had, less sort of overarching responsibility than they once had.
Yes, and I think like everything else, everything evolves, doesn't it? And if you look at the LMA Institute about the role of a manager, it breaks down into leadership, management, coaching. It breaks further down into technical, tactics, analytics, biomechanics, psychology, physiology, diet, nutrition, medical. So the
soccer bot 360.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So the main thing about being a leader and a football manager is actually don't do it on your own. And the backroom teams, compared to the names that you talked about, are now, you know, very significant. I think that the role of a manager and the role of a leader is such that probably the support role is now supplemented by, we've got about 50 technical directors in the game. Although the role technical director tends to vary from club to club and also title from club to club as well. But in the main, you have those guys that try to bring continuity, and where they support the manager, you're always going to have managers, you know, like Nick, you know, Tony Pulis, that you know well. You know, they're very strong individuals. They've got very clear philosophies about how they run. They've got very clear ideas about recruitment, and their instinct are very natural, and that's how they operate with their resilience and technical knowledge. As I would say, a lot of the young coaches now coming through are working in teams. If you look at what they're doing in France, they're working very much in physical teams, technical teams, tactical teams. So it's very much about working as teams going forward than the past.
There is a great example this week, isn't there, though, of a younger manager who is seems to be have a bit of the my way or the highway about him, with Arteta taking the armband away from Aubameyang and dropping him from the squad. As like, there's still a sense that he has to be the top of the pile and what he says goes. You know, even though he's the leader of a team, as you say, and even though he's comes from a foreign background, which would be more of a head coach thing. That's just a very old school managerial move, don't you think? To drop your captain, to go head to head with your captain.
Yeah, I think it's all about man management, and then unless you're actually working in that particular club or organisation, it's difficult to relate to that one particular incident. But, you know, Mikel is 39 years of age. He's a very talented leader and a manager. It's an evolving time for Arsenal. They need clarity about the role of the leaders at the top of the club in all the areas of business. And I'm sure that Mikel will be a very successful manager going forward. But all of the managers and the young managers that are out there, they all have to be successful in their early matches, and they all have to impart their own character and influence on the teams. They are the captain and the leader of that team.
There's a number of things, if I can jump in, Richard, that you've said that spark for me, which are First of all, you said about, you know, the physiology, the psychology, the preparation, the diet, etc., and the manager's team spreading almost like roots from his sort of trunk, you know, and he's got helpers on all of these things. Yes, that's changed. Certainly that, you know, you've got and this happens at cricket too now, you've got an incredible amount of people doing the jobs that would have once been one or possibly two people's jobs.
Well, you specialist throw-in coaches you have.
Well, for
or do they have their own association?
But equally, you know, in cricket, you know, you're bowling coaches and things like that. That never used to happen before. But in terms of, let's say, above the line, i.e. recruitment, you mentioned Tony Pulis. Clearly, and again, you said this, it varies from club to club to club to club to club, but it seems to me, and having spoken to a few managers, very few, but a few managers, you know, quite often, although this season I've seen this a couple of times, quite often the manager's head is called for when the problems are sometimes the chief execs or the policies of the owners. And I'm not talking about specific clubs here, but what I'm saying is we as fans treat the managers as we always have done, as in they live and die by what happens. But the truth is, I don't feel at some clubs that they are responsible for all of those decisions. In fact, I'm sure they're not.
Yes, and when you look at the tenure of a football manager over the years, and you know, since I've been working in the LMA with our teams, we've probably looked after over 1,000 managers and coaches leaving their jobs, about 200 professional practitioners, as I call them, managers and coaches will leave every season. So their hopes have been dashed at the beginning of the season to the end. But it is the reality. It's a business about winning football matches.
And carrying the can is part of the job description, really, isn't it? Being the the Aunt Sally for the outsiders.
Very difficult for an owner to remove players. It's very difficult for an owner to remove themselves. we probably could do with greater leaders in key positions, and maybe the role of how a club operates. I think it is evolving and it is changing. This season, we've lost about 20 managers. And you talked earlier about Mikel. Only 20 of the managers in the six leagues are actually overseas. And we need to really look at how clubs don't leave managers in isolation. If they don't manage the expectations of the fans and everybody working in and out of the club, and they don't manage the social media issues, which are growing all the time, then the manager is the one that tends to leave. But if you look at the really good clubs, success comes from loyalty to the manager in the main.
So a club would be a bad club if they have, like, let's say, for the sake of argument, 9 managers in 3 years. That would be a signal. That would be an alarm going off.
Well, I think you're probably talking about...
Just for the sake of argument, Oldham Athletic, maybe, you know, thinking.
Since the owner took over at Oldham, which was back in 2018, yes, they've got 9 managers. And that's some very, very good managers. And the last manager, Keith Kuehl, I have a great deal of respect for.
For sure. And and we've had decent managers. I think the last manager to last a whole season was Lee Johnson. And he was very good, I think, and is still, and is at Sunderland now, I think. And he was very good.
Yes.
But Oldham used to have, you know, used to be have a reputation as a club that found it very hard to sack him out. We had Jimmy Frizzell for 12 years and then Joe Royal for 12 years. And, you know, we've transformed into this, you know, 11 games and then you're sacked sort of organisation just in the last 3 years. It's very alien to us, I think.
You mentioned Jimmy Frizzell. When I started 14 years ago, Harry Wilkinson took me to meet him. Not county fame. What an amazing character he was. But if Oldham want to get back to the days of the 90s, when you're doing well, when you won the second division championship, when you got to the semi-final of the FA Cup, you have to create stability and you have to ensure continuation of investment and planning. And if that...
Well, you must know, you must see this more than anyone. You continually must be dealing with people who know this, who know that stability is part of, is an essential ingredient for moving a club forward. And yet you're forever dealing with them leaving, with them being moved on, with them carrying the can for something.
I think the trick is not boom or bust. And from an owner's perspective, it's trying to take a step back, understand what your budgets are, understand who your players, their limitations, their assets, and then working out where you should be by the middle end of season and making sure that you manage the expectations. But owners and directors are now coming under immense pressure themselves from social media. And this is a really interesting point that we've been looking at, particularly overseas owners. But when you look at the owners of our sporting clubs, not just football, they tend to be very successful people in their own rights. They tend to be successful business people, some with an ego, some without. But in the main, what they are is good decision makers in their own environment. So when they come into football and things go wrong, they don't know what to do. And often there's not the support mechanisms in the game for an owner to say to the FA or to the leagues, I need help here. I need to support my manager. I need to look at A and B. And they make decisions because they think they have to make decisions as opposed to actually taking time, taking stock, and not leaving their coaching staff in isolation.
Yeah. And do you know, funny enough, that was kind of where I was just about to go, which is that, and let's say specifically and not necessarily critically, the owners that have come in from outside who don't necessarily have a particularly long and complex relationship with the game of football in this country, as you say, if there's a problem, it wants fixing. There's something you mentioned earlier about managers, and it's also true about players, which is that there's an indefinable thing, which is quality. There's an indefinable thing, which is knowing how to have control over dressing room. There's an indefinable thing about getting people to play for you. There's an indefinable thing about players' form. You know, all of these things, which I think if you've been to, as Chris and I no doubt have, 1,000 football matches, you get an idea that these things are part of, although it doesn't always feel like it, part of the joy of football. If it could be commodified and made into an easily controllable thing, then it would lose some of its joy. So, for instance, Peter Coates at Stoke City, he's been a Stoke fan since the 40s. he has a great perspective on when we're doing badly, and loved it when we do well. But he does understand that, in a sense, it's about human frailty. That's what makes sport great. You know, the unforced human error makes sport exciting. You know, the keeper that fumbles, the centre half that slips. Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
But there are other things, aren't there, where because football, because only one team can win the league, and so you're arguably you're failing from second on downwards. There's a vulnerability for the vast majority of people in that profession, aren't there? I mean, it's because of the turnover and because of the can carrying thing.
Listening to Nick, I just wrote down success and failure in sport is rarely far apart. And we had a lecture in St. George's Park in the Institute a couple of months ago about COVID, comparing business and the services with sport. And there was a very good article written in the New York Times by the chief executive of the New York Times, called a man called Thompson. And he wrote, comparing about sport, that businessmen, because of COVID, don't have all the information on the decisions that they're now making. And actually, in sport, our leaders, so Eddie Jones and Sir Alex Ferguson have been meeting, talking about instinctive decision-making. So our sports leaders, our managers, our coaches, our captains on the pitch as well, and in rugby they do it very well, is they have to make decisions a lot from instinct. Whereas a lot of rest of us in our lives are getting as much information as we can, we're getting the finances, the business models, and then we're making decisions. But actually business doesn't have the time frame that it used to have. because of COVID, because of the changing world. The world's waking up to so many other issues. So actually, sport leaders have got some really, how they've evolved and how managers have become great leaders, I think is also not forgetting those instinctive qualities. I once asked Sir Alex, director of the LMA, and certainly a very big mentor for me over the years I worked at the LMA, I said to him, when did you realize that you wanted to become a manager? Or when did you realize you were going to become a good manager? And he's written about it a couple of times as well. But he said, I knew at the age of 12 in the playground when I was organizing the teams. So that's just in, you know, it's instinct, isn't it? And and I think
good leaders have that mentality,
But no pizza in those days, of course.
He also said something else that a good leader does, and certainly a football manager, if they're going to be successful, does. You must determine your own marketplace. You must take control of your own position in the market, whether you're a club, a business, a charity. And if you do that, then you can be in control. And if you recruit well, which probably is the most important thing a football manager has to get right in all of our clubs that we support, from Shrewsbury Town to Stoke to Oldham and all the Premier League teams, if they get the recruitment wrong at board level, at coaches level, at player level, they won't succeed. So making sure that the right team is supporting in recruitment. And as Carlo Ancelotti said, there are no more secrets in football anymore. So understanding how you improve your club through analytics and data is enormous these days as well. You almost need interpreters. Yeah.
Well, it must be a very important thing compared to other businesses, the recruitment side of things, because people that you bring into a club, you know, particularly a club like Oldham, because there's like a 12-month turnover of the complete playing staff, you know, because they can't afford to have them on long-term contracts. And so next summer, they'll all go and you completely change the playing staff. And it always seems to me to be unfair for the manager to carry the can for that if he's not allowed to be the one who chooses the players. If he's now nominally the head coach and someone else is in charge of the recruitment, which is the case at Oldham, they've just put in charge a man called Selim Benachour, who's a Tunisian guy who was the coach of our academy when Keith Curl was let go. And he's done all right, I think, so far. But they released a thing saying he's going to be the interim head coach, but he's not going to have any say in recruitment in January, if he's still around in January, because the owner's brother is in charge of that and has been in charge of that during the time when we've sacked 9 managers, you know. And he was recruiting. He was doing the recruitment all of that time. Yeah. And so, you know, it all seems a little bit unfair as far as that's concerned.
If you look at a lot of clubs in the last 24 months, they've recruited a lot of managers from the academies. And also about 20 of the managers working in the 92 clubs have actually played for those clubs as well, including the likes of Mikel. And so that tends to be about looking at a bit more towards longevity.
Well, it's a shortcut to a relationship with the fans as well, isn't it? If you bring if you let a favourite, recruiting Mikel Arteta is a no-brainer for Arsenal because he'll have a head start as far as
and Chelsea did the same with Lampard. And
they did,
yeah. I mean that thing about the academy is very interesting because if you are a chairman, not all chairman, but if you are a chairman and you think, if we could have 6 players in the first team that had come through the academy, suddenly financially you are in a much, much better place. And of course, if you are a manager that's clinging on for dear life, you're minded not to bring in young players. You know, it's the old cliche is you bring in a few old I remember Stoke signing Jerry Taggart, and he was fantastic for us, but that's what we needed at the time. Whereas you don't see that as much when they do that. I wonder if that appointing through the academy has not a cynicism, but a longer perspective to it than just he's the right man for the job.
I think all good points. And I think as well, if you bring players through the academies, many examples, the fans love it as well.
Yeah.
He's one of our own things.
Yes, and I think that's a really big connection. And actually not just players coming through as players, but also players becoming coaches, coaches becoming managers, managers becoming leaders. And if you can put into your club that structure, to help people progress in their personal and professional lives, then you're going to have much more success on the pitch. You're going to have a greater relationship with your fans. You're going to be a better employer. But coming back to your point about the Oldham and the owners, in the main, we're like a PLC football without a head office. Mm. It's a really important analogy, because what I mean by that is, which is what Tracy Crouch with the government review is looking at, and has looked at, is making sure that it doesn't really, you know, football needs good owners. It needs people to invest in their clubs. And actually what we need to make sure is that when an owner comes in, we need to make sure that those owners have a licensing structure, parameters in which they know how to behave, how to be supported, and how to help them ensure that their academies and the whole club is successful. So it's more about making sure, I think, including recruitment as well. So I'd like to see one championship owner rang me a couple of weeks ago about interviewing.
Go on, who was it?
interviewing for a particular senior coach. And his point to me was, I'd like somebody to join myself and one of their directors onto the panel, somebody with a lot of technical knowledge. And they were saying the FA doesn't have that, and maybe that's something that St George's Park should do. And it's certainly something that the whole game is looking at. And I would say, and I'm often the game's biggest critic at times, but I do believe that the last 24 months, whether it's COVID-related or not, I don't know, but the stakeholders have been far more open and transparent and wanting to work together. And I think that's something that is so important.
Yeah, apart from dropping the European Super League on us, you know, overnight.
I was thinking more domestic.
Yeah. So, look, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but this is a question that fascinates me anyway. Fuck the listeners. So, in terms of, and you're talking about the last 24 months, and you talk about things that have happened, and about the good of the game and you being critical, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So let me ask you, because this breaks my heart, is there a, and it's a difficult one, but is there a place for morality in football? Because what really upsets me about the Newcastle situation, I have no problem with the fans. I have no problem with, well, I have a problem with Mike Asher, but, you know, it's up to him if he sells the club. I don't particularly have a problem with Amanda Staveley. What I do have a problem with is there's all this talk about players going, and they're saying, oh, do they want to move to the Northeast? What about training? Couldn't they do this? Couldn't they do that? Managers, blah, 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 blah. And the question is never, could somebody turn this down on moral grounds? Yeah. That question never seems, it arises amongst fans, but it seems like you, and I don't want to preempt what you're going to say, but we get this cop out that sport and politics do not mix. Well, do you know what? There comes a time, doesn't there, when somebody should hold the hand up.
Well, first of all, I mean, that's a big question, but first of all, sport and politics have always mixed in my 14 years.
Yes, yeah.
And in my...
Look at the 1936 Olympics, for God's sake.
And actually, going back to my cricket days, I feel very angry that the ICC have let the game down so badly. And going back to 2003, 4, 5, 6, we were regularly meeting with the Foreign Office. We were regularly meeting with governments and MPs. So absolutely they do mix. And myself, Martin O'Neill and Steve Coffell gave evidence at the 2011 Select Committee about the running of the game. Secondly, about the moral issue, I once went on the Moral Maze program on BBC.
Did you?
And I've never been so lost in all my life or intellectually deficient.
Well, it's a maze.
And so I realised that I'm probably not very good at talking about morals. But what I do believe, because I've worked in sport and studied the structures of sport for a long time, is that if you basically the FA decentralised itself back in 1992, and you must have a pyramid system. You can't diverse the responsibilities. You need good leaders. But you have to, and I think it's a big issue for us in the game at the moment with the financing of the game. If, Nick, we could remove the us and them in football and change that to win. If you reflected that to, say, one of the greatest companies in the world, one of the biggest organizations in the world, you have that culture, you have that passion, you have that theme that runs through all of your organizations. And that's what we would need in football if we were to make sure that the decisions at the top are made more consistently, whether it's from a moral perspective or whether it's from a finance perspective or whether it's a world game perspective as well. Because when you look at, I saw that the FIFA on their website are promoting that their responsibility is to develop the game, to touch world and to better the future. Well, if they continue as they are in such atrocious communications with a lack of transparency, no accountability, and when they put something like the World Cup structure into the game, they don't fully explain it, they're going to fail more than they succeed.
Well, they're not a very moral organisation, I don't think.
The F is definitely not for football, is it? It's definitely for finance.
Yeah,
yeah. But and we're going to have to finish soon. But I mean, that's interesting. The whole that you were talking about the PCA and the ICC, and in fact, in some ways, UEFA work on the same model, which is let's have more, and FIFA, let's have more people with the same vote as the people that have been here for longer, which kind of makes sense. But really what it means is that the organizing committee has all of the power, because no individual country or group, a cabal, whatever you want to call it, of countries can influence it, because there are just so many involved, aren't
they? Yes. And actually, in Europe, quite interesting, speaking to Pep and Roberto Martinez and Gareth Southgate, our president, we're talking about bringing all the European national managers together, not just to help coaches from technical clinic perspectives, but also actually talking about the game, because we feel that with the hundreds of thousands of matches of experience that these men and women have, we should be contributing to the governance of the game in a more professional
Absolutely.
Way.
Mm. Absolutely. Richard, it's been great. And there's so many more things we could have talked about the biennial World Cup and this, that, and the other, and, you know, and holding your hands up for morality, etc. But it's been really fascinating. And I'm so glad that you gave your time to us.
No problem. Very welcome. And good to talk to you both.
Cheers.
Have a good Christmas.
And you.
We'll try. It depends on the results, doesn't it?
It's a results-led business.
Okay, thank you very much to everybody. Don't forget to review if you want to follow us on Twitter. And indeed, if you want to, just come round to my house, knock on the door and say, either you hate it or you love it. I really don't mind. I just like the company. I like the company.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.